Well, welcome, my friends, to The Catholic Reason, a radio production of St. Michael Catholic Radio based in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, where we think through various claims made by the Catholic Church concerning issues of faith, morality, and culture, and provide reasons behind those claims. My name is Carlo Broussard, staff apologist and speaker for Catholic Answers and a member of the Chancery Evangelization Team at the Diocese of Tulsa in eastern Oklahoma. The Catholic Reason airs locally here in Tulsa every Thursday from 4 to 5 p.m. on St. Michael Catholic Radio 94.9 and 102.9. But you may be listening on your own local Catholic radio station at a different time, since The Catholic Reason is now aired on Catholic stations throughout the country. So if you're listening outside of the Tulsa area, welcome and thanks for joining me. You can download the show through whichever podcast platform you use by subscribing to the Eastern Oklahoma Catholic Podcast. You can also access the archive episodes at carlobroussard.com under the audio tab. Just click on The Catholic Reason there. And one last thing, if you'd like to submit a question for me to answer on the air, you can do so by emailing me at Carlo, K-A-R-L-O, at saintstmichaelradio.com. We're starting to get a few questions in, and I'm going to be beginning to put those together for future episodes to have a segment for Q&A. So in last week's episode of The Catholic Reason, we looked at three reasons why people often reject religion. One reason was because most smart people are atheists. Most smart people reject religious beliefs, and that's why some people reject religion. A second reason was that religion is mere wish fulfillment to quell fears of life. And then a third reason was that people appeal to religion because thinking is hard. People just aren't willing to think for themselves, and that's why they embrace religion. And we gave reasons why these aren't good reasons to reject religion. But these aren't the only reasons why some people reject religion. There are others, and I'd like to consider those in today's episode. And so today's episode is more reasons why people reject religion. And we're going to look at four reasons. Reason number one, religion encourages belief without evidence. Some people think this, and consequently, they reject religion. Reason number two, religion does nothing but cause violence and conflict. Since religion causes violence and conflict, therefore, we ought to reject religion. Third reason, religious convictions are nothing but a product of social factors. So that's a reason why some people reject religion. And then fourthly, religion is coercive, and it's all about the desire for control and power. Now, our claim today is that these reasons, like the ones we looked at in last week's episode, do not rationally justify the rejection of religion. So let's start with the claim that religion encourages belief without evidence. Some will say religion is a betrayal of the intellect because it encourages belief without evidence. In last week's episode, we focused on the atheistic assumption that belief itself is irrational. But here, we're going to add an extra tidbit. And the idea here is that belief without evidence is irrational. And atheist Richard Dawkins makes this argument in his 1997 article he wrote for the Humanist Journal entitled, Is Science a Religion? Here's what he wrote. Faith, being belief that isn't based on evidence, is the principal vice of any religion. I repeat, faith, which is belief that isn't based on evidence. Notice how he's defining faith there. Belief without evidence. He says this is the principal vice of any religion. So for Dawkins, he's going to reject religious beliefs and religion because he thinks religious beliefs entails belief without evidence. Now, there's only basically one answer to this question, and that is Christianity, at least, is not a religion that encourages belief without evidence. So maybe this charge of Dawkins might stick with some other religion, but it doesn't stick with Christianity. In fact, it belongs to the Christian faith to base belief on the evidence of testimony. John the Evangelist viewed his own gospel and epistles as reasonable evidence for belief. So, for example, with regard to his gospel, in John 20:31, he writes, Jesus' signs are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. John sees his testimony of Jesus's miracles or signs as sufficient evidence to merit belief by those who couldn't see him perform the signs themselves. So notice John presents his testimony as the basis for belief, not belief without evidence, but a credible testimony, which constitutes evidence. He writes in a similar way in his first epistle in 1 John chapter 1, verses 1 through 3, quote, "That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon and touched with our hands concerning the word of life, that which we have seen and heard, we proclaim also to you, so that you may have fellowship with us." So consider this question. How could John be intending for Christians to practice blind faith, which is what Dawkins thinks religion entails, if John is offering his testimony, along with the testimony of the other apostles, as evidence for rational belief? To the non-believer who asks, why should I believe in Jesus? John is saying, because we saw him perform the miracles. We saw him risen from the dead. Folks, this is a far cry from blind faith. John is offering his eyewitness account as evidence to justify and merit rational belief. Now, someone may object that we need to assess whether John's testimony is credible. And that would be correct. Sure, we would. We would have to ask the question, is John lying? He says he's an eyewitness, but maybe he's lying. Is he reliable in telling us what Jesus said and did? Can we trust him? Is his testimony relaying accurate history as to what Jesus said and did? These are legitimate questions that we would ask and have to answer. Now, the bottom line response here is, once we do an investigation, we can answer, no, he was not lying, and yes, he was reliable in testifying to what Jesus said and did. And there's a lot of evidence in support of that, not only for John, but the other Gospels as well. And thus, given that historical ground and that historical evidence, they make it possible to historically investigate the reliability of their accounts. And given the evidence that we don't have time to get into today, that's for another episode, there is enough good evidence to merit a general approach of trust in what John and the synoptics report to us about Jesus. It would be different if John were saying, I proclaim to you Jesus, whom I and everyone else have never seen or touched. You just have to believe, right? In this case, there would be nothing subject to historical investigation, and thus one would have to make a blind act of the faith. And that would be reasonable to reject and say, no, thank you. But this is not what John is requiring of non-believers. So it belongs to Christian faith to believe based on evidence rather than make, as the Catechism states in paragraph 156, a blind impulse of the mind. As I stated in last week's episode, God has created us with an intellect. And so consequently, he does not demand that we leave the intellect or reason at the doorstep of faith. We must take our intellect across the threshold of faith. In other words, that faith needs to be rooted in reason, needs to be compatible with reason, cannot be a blind impulse of the mind, but must be a response to the evidence that reason has come to uncover. And according to at least the essence of Christianity, that evidence is eyewitness testimony of what Jesus said and did, particularly his miracles, the greatest being his resurrection. So rather than belief without evidence, it's actually belief in response to and based on credible evidence. That's the claim, at least. It would require much more work to justify that claim that the evidence in the testimony is credible. Again, that's something for a future episode. But at least we can say Christianity and the Christian religion and Christians that make up the Christian religion do not intend that non-believers just assent or believe without sufficient reasonable grounds to merit that assent or belief. Okay, so that deals with the first reason why people reject religion. The idea that it encourages belief without evidence, that is simply not the case when it comes to religion. That might be the case for some other religion, but not Christianity. So at least a skeptic should not reject Christianity on these grounds. Now, maybe perhaps someone might reject Christianity or religion in general because it does nothing but cause violence and conflict. There was an interview that popular atheist Sam Harris participated in 2006 in a Sun magazine article, and he was asked a question: if you could wave a magic wand and get rid of either rape or religion, which would you choose? And so here's what Sam Harris said in response: I would not hesitate to get rid of religion. I think more people are dying as a result of our religious myths than as a result of any other ideology. This is a common charge among many new atheists. Their belief that religion is a cause of violence in the world is a stumbling block that keeps many from considering Christianity. Now, I don't blame unbelievers for being repulsed by violent religious fanatics, but the existence of violent religious fanatics is not, so I will argue here, a good reason to reject Christianity. Moreover, religion itself is not the real problem, as we will see. And the fundamental response here is that this argument is a non sequitur. That's to say, the conclusion we ought to reject religion doesn't follow, there's your Latin non sequitur, it doesn't follow from the premise that religion is a source of conflict and violence. And I'm going to give five reasons why that conclusion does not follow from that premise. The first reason that we began to look at in this episode was the idea that religion encourages belief without evidence. And we gave an answer or a response to that claim and saying, well, that might be the case for some religions, but not Christianity. So at least a skeptic ought not to reject Christianity on those grounds, because it belongs to the essence of Christianity that we would have faith or belief based on credible testimony, the testimony of John and the synoptic gospel writers, not that it be a blind impulse of the mind. So that should not be a reason to reject at least Christianity. And we began to look at a second reason why people often reject religion, and that is because religion is a source of conflict and violence. And we quoted Sam Harris, a popular new atheist who in 2006 said he would rather get rid of religion than rape. And the reason being because he believes our religious beliefs or myths are more people have died because of those religious myths and beliefs than any other ideology. And before the break, I was giving a response to this objection, namely that this argument as to why we should reject religion is a non sequitur. That is to say, the conclusion we ought to reject religion does not follow from the premise religion is a source of conflict or violence. And I'm going to give five reasons why that conclusion does not follow from the premise. And the first of which is by way of intuition. We can look to an intuitive example to see how this conclusion wouldn't necessarily follow. And that is conflict over land. Think about it. If we should reject religion in general, simply because it's a source of violent conflict, well, shouldn't we also reject the idea of owning land, since land has been and still is a source of violent conflict? The conclusion, religion is bad, no more follows from the premise religion is a source of violence than the conclusion land is bad follows from the premise land is a source of violence. Or to state it differently, the conclusion we should reject religion no more follows from the premise religion is a source of violence than the conclusion we should reject land follows from the premise land is a source of violence. Kings and countries have fought and still fight over disputed land, but that doesn't mean we should rid ourselves of private property. Similarly, just because individuals fight in the name of religion, it doesn't follow that we should rid our world of religion. There may be other grounds on which someone rejects Christianity or any religion, but at least he cannot reasonably do so on the grounds that religion has been a source of violence. If he were to be consistent with that logic, he would have to reject owning private land, which I think most people of right reason and goodwill would reject and say, no, we can't go that far. So that at least begins to intuitively signal to us something is awry with this line of reasoning. in this objection, we should reject religion because it's a source of conflict and violence. Now, here's a second reason that goes beyond mere intuition as to why that conclusion, we should reject religion, doesn't follow from the premise, it's a source of conflict and violence. The violence could be just violence. Violence considered of itself is bad, but sometimes it can be justified. Perhaps violence is necessary to defend innocent human beings who are being attacked. Even if such violence were done in the name of religion, we shouldn't have a problem with it if it's done as a defense of innocent human beings. So this could be a reason why we shouldn't reject religion just because it's a source of violence. The violence may be justified. Now, a skeptic who makes this objection might just qualify the objection to restrict his objection to unjust violence. And that's fine. That's okay. But this objection, if the restricted version of the objection, restricting it only to unjust violence, still doesn't succeed as a justifiable reason to reject religion outright when unjust violence is enacted in the name of religion. Okay? And here's the reason why. Unjust violence could be with a religion and not religion per se. Notice, a skeptic might reject Christianity because he automatically thinks all religions, including Christianity, encourage violence in the name of God. But this is simply not true. Although it may belong to the essence of a religion or some religions to do violence in the name of God and to persuade others to believe the religion by force, it doesn't belong to all religions. We have to distinguish between the commitments that different religions require. So on this restricted version of the argument or the objection, restricting the violence to unjust violence, again, the unjust violence could be with a or some religions, but not religion itself. And so for this reason, we shouldn't just outright reject religion itself because it's sometimes a source of conflict and violence. The unjust violence might be due to the precepts of a particular religion, not religion itself. Now, a fourth reason why this argument is a non sequitur, that is to say, why the conclusion we should reject religion doesn't follow from the premise as a source of conflict and violence. The unjust violence that's perpetrated could be a perversion of a particular religion. Since we're trying to remove obstacles to Christianity, we need only focus on whether Christianity encourages violence, such as conversion by the sword, right? And so if somebody were to go around trying to persuade others to Christianity by the sword or by force, then based upon the teachings of Jesus and early Christians themselves, that would be a perversion. That violence would be a perversion of the Christian religion, thus constituting a reason why the conclusion we ought to reject religion doesn't follow from the premise it's a source of violence. So consider, for example, Jesus in Matthew 5, 43 through 44. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. That seems to be directing his followers. Jesus seems to be directing his followers away from any sort of violence offered toward their enemies. Rather, we're to manifest love. Matthew 25, 42, put your sword back, he tells Peter, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword. In that particular case, Jesus reprimands Peter and says to not engage in any sort of violent activity. Now, these words don't sound anything like an encouragement to spread the Christian message by violence. And so that's Jesus. But consider also quotes from early Christian writers. We could take the mid-third and early fourth early Christian author and advisor to the first Christian emperor, Constantine Lactantius. He writes this in his Divine Institutes. There is no occasion for violence and injury, for religion cannot be imposed by force. The matter must be carried on by words rather than by blows, that the will may be affected. So that's like Tansius. Consider also the 4th century theologian Hilary of Poitiers to Constantius. He writes this, God does not want unwilling worship, nor does he require a forced repentance. So that's Christianity in general, right? Catholic Christianity promotes at the same time the respect of every person's dignity as a free human being. So we have magisterial support of what we know from Jesus and early Christian testimony, that we are to respect every person's dignity as a free human being, to direct themselves as to what they're going to believe without the threat of physical coercion. So the Second Vatican Council teaches in its document Dignitatis Humanae in section 10, quote, man's response to God in faith must be free. No one, therefore, is to be forced to embrace the Christian faith against his own will. In imitation of Jesus, who bore witness to the truth in John 8:32, Christians are called to propose the gospel of Jesus and invite others to believe in it, but not to use force to impose it. And that's a direct quote, again, from Dignitatis Humanae, section 11. We are to not to use force to impose the Christian religion. Now, our skeptic friend can rest assured that persuasion by violence is not part of the Christian religion. It's not an essential precept. So Christians who have carried out violent acts in the name of God throughout history only show their failure to live up to Christian standards. Such violence is an abuse of the Christian name and thus a perversion of Christianity. But just because someone abuses something doesn't mean that the thing is bad in itself. Now, perhaps a skeptic's revulsion to violence in the name of the religion should be the very reason why he should become Christian, right? He would fit right in. His revulsion to the unjust violence would fit within the teachings of Christianity, which involve a revulsion to unjust violence. There ought to be no unjust violence perpetrated in the name of the Christian religion. Now, somebody might counter here and say, well, it's not really religion itself, but maybe they might refine their objection to say that truth claims themselves is what's causing the conflict. So sure, I can see the distinction between what Christianity teaches and Christians who fail to live up to the standard. But my problem is with the claim that one is right and the other is wrong. That's the source of violence, since it breeds competition as to who's right and who's wrong. So maybe that's really the problem and the hang-up for someone who's rejecting religion. One reason that we looked at so far in today's episode was that religion encourages belief without evidence. But we saw that that might apply to some religions, but it doesn't apply to Christianity, because it belongs to the essence of Christianity that our faith be based on the credible testimony of John and the synoptics and what they tell us about what Jesus said and what he did. John presents his eyewitness testimony as the grounds for one to believe in Jesus, presenting eyewitness accounts of Jesus's miracles. That is a far cry from a blind impulse of the mind or belief without evidence. So this would not be a reason to reject Christianity, although it might be a reason to reject some other religion that entails belief without evidence. And then we looked at another reason why people reject religion, and that is because religion is a source of conflict and violence. And in our response, we basically said that that's a non sequitur. The conclusion that we ought to reject religion doesn't follow from the premise that religion is a source of conflict and violence. And we gave four reasons in our last segment as to why that conclusion doesn't follow. I mentioned five reasons, I think, but there are actually four. Number one, by way of intuitive examples. So we wouldn't follow that logic when it comes to land. Just because land, private property, is often a source of conflict and violence, most people of goodwill and right thinking wouldn't say, well, I guess we got to reject having private land. That conclusion would not follow from that premise. Most people would not reject private land because it's often a source of conflict and violence. So that intuitive example and an appeal to intuition signals to us that something is awry with this line of reasoning. Now, the second reason why we should not reject religion based upon religion being a source of conflict and violence is because sometimes the violence might be justified if members of a religion are coming to the defense of innocent human beings and even engaging in the violent activity in the name of the religion to defend the innocent. That would be justified violence. And so for this reason, we should not reject religion simply because it's a source of violence and conflict, because the violence and conflict might be justified. The third reason why this conclusion doesn't follow from the premise is because sometimes the unjust violence is due to a religion and not religion itself. So there might be some religions that have essential principles that teach we must persuade by the sword, but not all religions. And then the fourth reason why the conclusion doesn't follow is that the unjust violence could be a perversion of the religion. So even those, for example, Christians who go about trying to persuade people by violence in the name of Christianity would be perverting the name of Christianity. And we gave evidence that that would be so. We have evidence from Jesus himself, early Christian testimony, and even specifically Catholic Christianity from the Second Vatican Council, showing us that it belongs to the essence of Christianity to propose and invite people to believe rather than to force them to believe, because faith necessarily involves a free assent. And so we ought not to reject religion based upon the premise that religion is a source of violence and conflict, because the unjustified violence may very well be a perversion of a religion. And so those were the four reasons we gave why the conclusion we ought to reject religion doesn't follow from the premise religion is a source of conflict and violence. Now, someone might counter here and say, well, I can see the distinction between what Christianity teaches and what Christians fail to live up to, and Christians failing living up to that standard. But my problem, so it might be argued, is with the claim itself that one is right and the other is wrong. That's the source of violence, because it breeds competition. Now, maybe there are some who let me just say it like this. Sociologically, there might be some truth to this, where there are truth claims that contradict and there is violence that arises from that. But for us as Christians and for Christianity, one doesn't necessarily follow from the other, right? We shouldn't reject Christianity because it makes a truth claim. Christianity, it is true, and specifically Catholic Christianity, claims to have the full truth about God and his son, Jesus Christ. But note, as we mentioned in our prior segment, it also promotes at the same time the respect of every person's dignity as a free human being. Again, to quote the Second Vatican Council from its Dignitatis Humani, man's response to God and faith must be free. No one, therefore, is to be forced to embrace the Christian faith against his own will. In imitation of Jesus, who bore witness to the truth in John 8:32, Christians are called to propose the gospel of Jesus, to bear witness to the truth and invite others to believe it, but not, to quote Dignitatis Humani again, to use force to impose it. So if a Christian becomes violent toward others he thinks are wrong, then he would be, once again, abusing the Christian name and thus promoting a perversion of Christianity. So for us as Christians, we can make truth claims and at the same time respect another person's freedom as a free agent to assent to those claims or not, rather than forcing them by force or by the sword or threatening them with death or limiting their freedom. So again, if our skeptic friend's revulsion to violence in the name of religion is the reason why he's rejecting Christianity, well, rather than that being a reason to stay away from Christianity, he ought to join Christianity because he would fit right in, because we are revulsed at the idea of persuasion by force as well. Okay, so now we come to a third reason why people reject religion, and that is it's often believed that religious convictions are nothing but a product of social factors. And often it takes the following form. If you grew up in another country with a different set of religious beliefs, then you'd hold the beliefs of that place and the time in which you live. Notice the implied assumption. Our religious beliefs are nothing but the product of social factors. So depending upon what society you're in at what time, that's your religious, that's going to determine your religious beliefs. So your religious beliefs are going to be different whether you live in one place or another at some other time or another. Now, I'm going to give three responses here. There are three reasons why this is not the case, why this argument fails. It's simply not true that religious believers hold to their beliefs because of circumstances of upbringing. There are many people who believe that God exists because they have thought long and hard about the question, even doing so in environments that were antagonistic to belief in God. And so that they actually come to the conclusion that God exists shows that they can and have transcended and arisen above the factors of their social environment, and thus are not restricted to and conditioned by solely conditioned by the social factors. Secondly, it's an arbitrary principle. This logic, the logic embedded in this objection, is never applied to moral views. And this is where we can kind of turn the table here. So consider this. Should we conclude that our belief that women have equal rights is irrational? Because on this view, such a belief is only an accident of our upbringing, and we probably wouldn't hold this belief if we grew up in Saudi Arabia. Of course not, right? We're not going to think our belief that women are equal to men insofar as they're human beings is irrational simply because we've been raised in an environment that is conducive to that and has promoted that belief. That belief is true, right? Regardless of where we grow up, which leads to the third response to this objection. It only explains motivations, and it doesn't bear on whether the belief is true or false. Just because a belief emerges from a society into which a person is born, it doesn't follow that the belief isn't true. Suppose, for example, I convince you without evidence that it's raining outside. Does the lack of evidence mean that you believe something that's untrue? Absolutely not. It could very well be raining outside, in which case your belief would be true. It would map on to reality. You simply would not have the evidence to justify that claim. So the motivations behind a person's religious beliefs don't have any bearing on whether a claim is true or not. And to focus on motivations, it's simply a distraction from the real question. The real question is whether the belief that God exists, or whether Christianity is true, or whether women have equal rights insofar as they are human beings, equal rights to like with men insofar as they are human beings. The question is whether these claims are true, not what's the motivating factors for those beliefs. Could there be someone who believes these things simply because that's how they have been raised? Yes, that's possible. And we recognize that. But that it doesn't follow from that that we ought not to adopt those beliefs, because those beliefs may very well be true. And we need to inquire as to whether those beliefs are true to see if we ought to assent to them, regardless of the social factors. And so all this objection shows is that for some, social factors may be a determining factor for one's religious beliefs. And secondly, it might give us pause and caution to assess our religious beliefs to see whether they're merely whether I hold a religious belief because of my social upbringing, or do I hold my religious belief because I think it is true and I have good reason to think so. That's a good thing. And that's something that this objection does call to mind and bring to the fore. So we've been looking at reasons why people reject religion. More reasons, because in last week's episode, we looked at three. We're looking at four today. We've already looked at three. Let's move to the fourth reason, and that is religion is coercive and all about the desire for control. There's one particular individual who's a self-described liberal Christian and co-founder of Forward Progressives by the name of Alan Clifton. He thinks religion is coercive. He puts it plainly online in his article, Organized Religion, a Tool for Ignorance, Power, and Control. He says that's what organized religion is, control. And so he's an example that manifests this sort of objection. So But here's a question. What does Clifton mean by control? And he seems to basically have two ideas in mind, and we'll consider each in turn. The first target meaning of control is persuading people. That's what he means by control. Here's what he writes. I detest organized religion. What religion is to me is a human-made concoction meant to promote the personal views of some while degrading the views of others. It's one group of humans telling another that they're wrong. If you want to believe in Jesus Christ or Muhammad, I don't care. As long as you're not taking that faith, forming it into a belief, and then forcing it on others. So how do we respond to this? Notice there what he means by control is simply trying to persuade others, telling them they're wrong, you're right. In response, the problem here is that Clifton does the very thing he condemns religion for doing. First of all, he's promoting his view that religion is just an invention for people to get control over others, while at the same time condemning the view that religion is not an invention for people to get control over others. So he's doing the very thing he says religious believers do. Secondly, he tells religious believers that they're wrong for believing that some beliefs are wrong. Again, a double standard? Yes. It's okay for him to tell us we're wrong, but not okay for us to tell others they're wrong. And then thirdly, he takes his view that religion is an invention for people to get control over others, forms it into a belief, and he's quote-unquote forcing it on religious believers by saying they should detest religion as he does. So he's trying to get us to conform to his view. So in the end, Clifton is just as guilty of control as he claims religious leaders are. If he rejects organized religion because it's nothing more than a control-seeking scheme, i.e. trying to get others to adopt your view, well, then he needs to give up his belief that organized religion is invented for control because he's trying to get us to adopt his view. Now, a second response is, what's so bad about saying to someone your belief is false, right? What's so bad about telling someone his belief doesn't map onto reality? Because that's what we mean when we say the belief is false. That's basically what we do when we say any belief is false. And shouldn't we concern ourselves about what's real, what's true, in order that we might live in accord with that reality? Clifton himself inadvertently acknowledges that we should. He argues that members of different religions are, quote, pretty much the same, and that our core values as human beings are basically identical. He identifies these core values as being a good person, helping the helpless, and defending the defenseless. And then Clifton then asks, isn't that what life is about? Isn't that what we should all strive to be as humans? The implication here is that life is about the above or the previously mentioned core values, and that we should strive for them as humans. Well, to say life is about being a good person, helping the helpless, and defending the defenseless is a statement about reality. And to say we should strive to live in accord with these core values is to say that we as human beings should live in accord with reality. Again, Clifton does the thing he condemns organized religions for doing. If the targeted meaning of control is persuading others to adopt your view, which he seems to hold, that's what he means by control. But on that interpretation of control, this man, this individual, Clifton, is guilty of doing the same thing that he's charging organized religious leaders of doing. And then ultimately, guys, there's nothing wrong with trying to persuade others to reality so that they can live in accord with reality. Now, there's a second meaning that Clifton seems to have in mind by control, and that is a hunger for positions of power within a community. He writes this with a bit of sarcasm, and this is where he manifests this other meaning of control. It's an easy way to take a group of people with like-minded beliefs, group them together, and manipulate them for some kind of ulterior goals. Heck, just look through history, he says. Religious leaders often perpetuated that specific kings or emperors were ordained by, fill in whatever god they believe in, he says, and for the people to rise up against them would be blasphemy. To question their rule was to go against God, quote-unquote God, thus risking damnation. It's genius, isn't it? Right? So for Clifton, religious leaders do nothing but capitalize on whatever belief system a group of people happen to embrace and position themselves to gain power and authority over those people. This is another meaning of control that Clifton seems to have in mind. So the first meaning, again, was simply persuading others to adopt your view. We gave evidence that he seems to envision that, but here he seems to be shifting in a view of control as religious leaders simply trying to gain power and authority over the people that they that are subject to them. My first response here is that it might be true for some. It might be true for some religious leaders that they are self-serving and hunger for power and have a disordered desire for power. But that doesn't mean all religious leaders are like that. In fact, most religious leaders, whatever faults they may have, are not power-hungry psychopaths, but sincerely believe what they teach. Therefore, it would be reasonable to reject religion. It would be unreasonable to reject religion wholesale on the basis that religion is a power trip game, because not all religious leaders are like that. Some are, but not all. This is very similar to the objection, well, we should reject religion because it's a source of conflict and violence. Well, that might be true for some religions, that it belongs to their essential principles to promote their religion by violence, but not all religions. So too here. It might be true for some religious leaders that they have disordered desires for power and try to lord it over their subjects, but not true of all religious leaders. Now, secondly, history simply doesn't bear this out. It doesn't bear out the claim that all religious leaders manipulate commonly held beliefs for the sake of power. As my colleague and good friend Jimmy Akin at Catholic Answers points out in his book, A Daily Defense, most religions grew organically without a specific founder. The leaders of such religions, whether village priests or tribal shamans, shared the beliefs of those they served, inheriting them from previous generations. There's the social factor thing there. So they didn't see themselves as beyond beliefs held by the people they led. Rather, for some, they were embedded in that belief tradition and thus didn't view themselves as being able to, nor did they desire to, manipulate those beliefs for self-serving purposes. So some religious leaders did not manifest self-serving purposes. As to those religions that did have a specific founder, there is a mixture of the good and the bad. Some religious founders did benefit materially, such as Muhammad and Joseph Smith, but others renounced wealth and power, such as Gautama Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, right? Still others refused political power and suffered greatly for their beliefs to the extent of giving up their lives. And Jesus is the example par excellence of this. So Jesus clearly did not manifest any desire for earthly power because he actually rejected it and died for it. And so regardless of how we interpret control, given this objection, whether the control is simply persuading others to adopt your belief, or the control is a disordered desire and hunger for power to lord that power over the subjects of those that the religious leaders rule, whether we take control on either meaning, neither of them are persuasive for us to reject religion itself. Religion is not simply about coercion and all about the desire for control over others. That is manifestly false. It is historically false. It is factually false. Yet again, we have a mere assertion without any sort of evidence. And just because you can point to some individual or a group of religious leaders who have manifest a desire for control and power and abused it, that doesn't mean all are like that. And then finally, I would answer that not all control is bad, right? Notice that Clifton assumes that control is necessarily evil, and since it's involved in religion, we need to reject religion. But not all control is bad. You can have control, which is a governance over those whom you are leading and directing to what is good for them. And control or authority can be utilized for that which its purpose is, for the good of those that you exercise the authority over. And that's what we call servant leadership. So one should not reject religion simply because it manifests a desire for control over others. Well, my friends, that's all the time we have for this week's episode of The Catholic Reason. We looked at four reasons why some people reject religion. It encourages belief without evidence. That's not true for Christianity. It does nothing but cause violence and conflict. We gave reasons why that's flawed thinking. Religious convictions are nothing but a product of social factors. That's manifestly false. Religion is coercive and all about the desire for control. And we gave reasons why that is not true. So our Catholic claim is that these are not good reasons to reject religion. And I think we made good on this claim. Friends, thanks for listening to The Catholic Reason, a production of St. Michael Catholic Radio based in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. You can download the show through whichever podcast platform you use by subscribing to the Eastern Oklahoma Catholic Podcast. You can access the archived episodes at CorlaBrusor.com under the audio tab. I invite you to join me again next week for The Catholic Reason as we continue looking at Catholic claims and the reasons behind them. Tell a friend. I'll talk to you then. God bless.